This is the New Books Network, and I'm Natalia, one of the hosts on the Literary Studies channel. Today I have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Scott Donaldson, the author of a number of biographies, A Poet in America, Winfield Tony Scott, By Force of Will, The Life and Art of Ernest Hemingway, John Cheever biography, Archibald MacLeish, An American Life, and for this book, Scott Donaldson received the Ambassador Book Award. And the book we will be discussing today is The Impossible Craft Literary Biography, which was published by Pennsylvania State University Press in 2015. Hello, Scott Donaldson. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Hello, Natalia. Thanks for calling.
So before we start discussing your recent publication, would you tell us about your career as a biographer, as a teacher, as a professor, as a scholar? In The Impossible Craft, you share a bit about your life and career. And if you could tell us what attracted you to this career, to this field, how did that interest take shape? That would be wonderful.
Okay, thanks. I started out as a newspaper man. Got out of the Korean War and didn't have any particular profession. And luckily, through a contact, I got a job as a cub reporter on the Minneapolis Star, which is one of the major Middle Western daily newspapers. And I was there for a year and a half and learned amazing amounts of things from my colleagues, many of whom were veterans from Chicago Sun-Times, Chicago Daily News, Chicago Tribune, New York Post, New York Daily News, New York Times. Many of them, toward the end of their careers, there were, in fact, an assemblage of mostly Irish drunks. But they knew a hell of a lot, and they were brilliant. They were like, you know, people could take a story on the phone and make it five times better than the chap who was giving them the information. So it was a tremendous learning experience, and also, working on a daily newspaper, you have to produce copy, you know. And so every day I'm churning out copy, and you're getting that habit. So after doing that for a few years and starting a paper of my own for a while doing some other kinds of PR work, I finally decided to go back and get a PhD at Minnesota in American Studies, which was a wonderful place to go and a very good teaching and a great learning experience for me. And of course, I was of a certain age by then, and so I got to zoom through my PhD and did it in less than 3 years, which is unheard of course. But anyway, so I got my doctorate and started looking around for a place to teach, and William & Mary is one of the three places that I got job offers, and I decided to go there. And very glad I did. It was it was a fine place to go. Then a sleepy Southern college, but about to become much less sleepy, much more active, and much less a Southern institution than a national small university. So I got there, and I got to teach Hemingway and Fitzgerald, which had been my primary two interests among American writers, I suppose. And after a while, and I still want to turn out copies. So I'm publishing articles and, you know, in the places you're supposed to publish American literature. And over time, Sewanee Review was a favorite place. But then I started, I really want to write books. And so what you do as a newspaper man, you're really writing about people all the time. And as you, that segues into your fascination with the lives and careers of people like Scott Fitzgerald and Ernest Hemingway and John Cheever and Archie MacLeish and E.A. Robinson and others that I've written about. But I decided that I would try to start writing a biography. Mm-hmm. Chap came to town and just done a biography of Ezra Pound recently. Came down to Williamsburg, Virginia. And I went to hear him say, what you must do as a beginning biographer is read everything that your subject has written and read everything about the subject, whatever other everybody else has written. Then, after you've done that, you may begin to think about trying to make a story out of it. So, of course, I followed that good advice. And my first book was on a minor poet named Winfield Townley Scott, who I discovered in graduate school in Minnesota. It was a lot of fun to do. He's a minor poet, but that doesn't mean he's a poor poet. It just means he didn't have a huge reputation. He's a very fine poet and had a very complicated and difficult life. And died of an overdose of a toxic mix of alcohol and drugs. Probably may or may not have been intentional. Who knows? He had a it's odd, but a number of the subjects I was dealing with were suicidal or, well, Hemingway, of course, is a classic case. Fitzgerald did try to kill himself a couple of times. Winfield Townley Scott probably was willing to exit this world when he took that overdose. Anyway, that doesn't mean I'm ghoulish, I don't think, but it says a lot about the difficulty of being a writer at any time, where there's never enough recognition of what you do as you see it. If you're someone, writers like John Cheever, for example, young aspiring writers would write to him and say, "Well, what, I think I want to be a writer. What should I do about it?" Well, the thing to do is to discourage them because, one out of 50, those aspirants may be capable of doing good work and doing publishable work. Although now, of course, everything can be published, but that was not true 50 years ago. And so when I started writing books. So anyway, that's how I got started writing biography. And then, of course, I went on from this minor poet to my second book was on Hemingway, third on Fitzgerald, and then progressed with other writers that I was interested in.
Well, thank you so much. And I was really impressed with your own journey that you shared in this book. I found it extremely inspiring, and I just said to myself, wow, it's such a very rich life, meeting all the people and writing about all these people and entering, so to speak, their lives. I think that's the notion that you kind of mentioned in your book, that when you write a biography, you kind of enter other people's life. You mentioned a couple of times Hemingway and Fitzgerald, and you wrote a couple of biographies on each of them and on both of them, Hemingway versus Fitzgerald, The Rise and Fall of a literary Friendship. And you also mentioned that it was your primary academic interest at the beginning. So could you tell us just a little bit about why Fitzgerald and Hemingway? What is it about these two writers that attracted you the most?
Well, to begin with, I had a sense of semi-identification with them. I'm a Middle Western guy. They both were. Fitzgerald grew up across the Mississippi River from where I grew up in Minneapolis and St. Paul. My mother, although we never talked about this, she died when I was quite young, may have danced with Fitzgerald. She went to St. Paul Central High School, which is the area where he lived in St. Paul. I felt like, and of course Hemingway came from the suburb of Chicago, but they're both little Western guys, and that one could relate to. So that was part of it. Mm-hmm. And then, I discovered Hemingway as a young man, very young man, as a boy, and then wrote my senior paper at Yale. An intensive English major on Hemingway's short stories. So I got a fast start on that, and I didn't really come to know Fitzgerald's work all that well until later. So Hemingway was my first connection and the one I was most dedicated to pursuing. But, you know, Fitzgerald soon took a parallel place in my universe with Ernest. And they both remained that way. It's a curious thing because there's a kind of rivalry between Fitzgerald scholars and Hemingway scholars, but luckily I seem to have a safe passage into both camps, and I can talk about them when we go to meetings, that sort of thing. But the Hemingway versus Fitzgerald book, which is, I guess, the most successful one I've had financially. Not that any biographer is likely to make very much money, but Anyway, so that's how I got started with Hemingway for sure.
Okay. Well, so I mentioned just a few of those biographies that you wrote, and probably all of them have some dear memories for you. And which one is the dearest to you?
Dearest?
Yeah.
Okay. I thought you were going to ask me something more interesting, like which was the most painful. But we can get to that later. I guess the first one. I guess one Scott is a minor figure, but I really liked him, and maybe because he hadn't been that successful, I could feel more of a sense of identification with him than with any of the other writers who were, after all, famous.
Mm-hmm.
In a way, so. Another close sense of identification was the last book before Impossible Craft was called Death of a Rebel, the Charlie Fenton story. And Charlie Fenton was the teacher at Yale who had the misfortune of directing my senior thesis on Hemingway short stories. And we became friends of a sort at that time, and I always admired Charlie. He was one of these charismatic teachers, and handsome, young-looking. He'd been in the war. He'd been at the RAF, flying bombing missions, and at Yale at that time, I was class of 1950, which gives you an idea how ancient I am. But it was very exciting to have a teacher standing up there in his Glen plaid jacket and slim, handsome guy talking about irreverently about the war and about his experiences and about how to write short stories. So, Charlie Fenton died, and then the year before Hemingway did, so that would have been 1960. And by jumping off the top floor of a hotel in Durham, North Carolina, so another suicide. But I wanted to try to find out what had led him to that position. And love had something to do with it, and a broken marriage, a possibly fractured week, a new connection that might or might not have worked out. He was sure it would, and then all of a sudden you're not so sure. And I think I did a reasonably good job of understanding how it was that Fenton sank into that whirlpool of depression that overtakes the suicidal, and you can't swim against it. Wow. But it was a book I always wanted to do because he's not a major thinker. He wrote very good stuff. But he didn't live long enough to accomplish all that much. He wrote one of the very best first books on Hemingway, though.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so that was Charlie. That was someone else I felt very close to.
Mm-hmm.
The other writers I suppose are I met John Cheever, for example, but only briefly. And but as you go, and you know, as you tackle any one of these waves, it's for me a 4 or 5 year project.
Right.
It's an elephantine pregnancy before the book issues. And obviously you come to know a great deal about your subject and about and never enough, but you finally get the stage, you think, well, there may be more I need to know, but I've got to, sooner or later, you've got to get words down on paper, and so you do that. But you know, 4 or 5 years per biography, which is pretty much my pattern, I think gives each subject a chance to develop and to emerge as a verifiable human being, and as well, of course, as a brilliant writer. Otherwise, why would I be doing the book in the first place? You know, so you begin with that kind of. I can't imagine writing a book about a writer whose work I didn't like or admire. I mean, that would be years of torture, I would think. You know, but so.
So it's quite inevitable to develop some dear memories about each of them while you're working on each biography for 5-6 years.
Yeah. You do. I always, there's nobody, and this doesn't always work out. I mean, there are famous cases like Mark Shore becoming totally disillusioned with Sinclair Lewis, for example, when he did this massive body and stuff like that. The more he knew about Lewis, the less he liked him, and so that can happen. You know, you can get a writer whose behavior outside of his accomplishment is execrable. It's without, you know, it's hard to admire somebody who, and you know, so who behaves badly, and I never achieved any kind of animosity toward any of my subjects. Always a sense of sympathy and admiration, and trying above all to reach a kind of understanding of what was going on in their life, what was going on in their work, and the connections such as they were between those two things. So
your first biography was Poet in America, Winfield, Tony Scott. Is that?
Yeah.
Yeah, and it was published 1977.
Okay, I guess it was.
Yeah. So, and The Impossible Craft is based on all those experiences that you had ever since, and it offers some sort of a very cohesive and coherent vision of biography and a biographer as well. So what's your interpretation of this very interesting genre, biography, and what's your vision of a biographer as well? I know that you mentioned that mythical concept of an ideal biographer in this book, and if you could say a couple of words about biography as a genre and biographer as a profession or as a field in writing, so that would be wonderful.
Okay, well, it's a fascinating thing to do, to write a biography. You begin, as I suggest, with admiration for your subject, and you learn more and more as you go along, and you're reading and writing and talking to people, and almost always I was dealing with someone whose relatives, at least, were alive, whose children or grandchildren. Sometimes, as with Cheever, many people were available to interview, but and then you collect all of these notes, and you know, what's interesting is how patterns emerge. Mm-hmm. So what are you going to say about somebody like him anyway? Well, you could say about Hemingway, as I think I ended up doing, is that he wanted to be master of everything he pursued. So he did not only want to be a great writer, but he wanted to be the world's champion drinker. Wanted to know everything about bullfights more than anybody else, about boxing and about deep sea fishing and hunting, and he was a tremendous autodidact. He never went to college, but he taught himself everything. So, you know, I don't know where I started on this track, but anyway, that's one of the fascinating things about Hemingway. There's sometimes deplorable things in these writers' lives. That's one of the problems of doing biography, if I can segue into that subject, is that the accomplishment, the writing, mm-hmm. books of poetry, the novels, short stories, whatever, are there, and they're very good. And you admire them, and you admire the person who wrote them. Good, that's a great start. But the actual lives of most writers tend to be messy, tend to be complicated, tend to be, that's what Carlos Baker decided after spending, 15 years writing his first and still very useful biography of Hemingway, that man was just more complicated. You know, we think of him as a simple figure, Papa with the beard and the weapons and as a kind of macho figure, mm-hmm. which of course is semi ridiculous if you read his work, but never mind. And that's gotten corrected over time, but that was a pose for him. That pose of him, he liked that. Okay, everybody thought it was a smart Papa. I mean, Pacha, I know his picture in Life magazine. When he died, he's front page of Pravda, front page of New York Times, front page all over the world. It was a big story. He was an international famous writer. Parallel, I'll say, to Mark Twain in the late 19th century. One of these people who spoke across nations and continents. Okay, but, but he had four wives. He was not wonderful with his children. He didn't give them all the attention one might have thought he could. But it would have been very difficult for Hemingway to live such an exemplary life as to parallel the wonderful trove of material he left behind. And he would not have been able to write that wonderful material had he been just a sweetheart. It just doesn't work that way. Writers have to be some kind of psychic kink, I think, bothering them, attacking them always, leading them to despair, leading them to, by God, get the words down on paper. At least I can do that, so...
So, like you mentioned, lives are very complicated, and it's probably even more complex to write about others' lives. And obviously, this work is very selective, and depending on what you select to include into the biographies you write will somehow shape that image of the writer and will shape our understanding even sometimes of the works they wrote. So, how do you decide what to choose in terms of those facts that you will include into biography, and how do you decide what to leave behind probably and not to include, and obviously those items which will remain, so to speak, silenced, they will somehow also shape our understanding of the writers we read about. So what's your approach to that selective work? You mentioned the words of Mark Shorer in your book, The Impossible Craft, who said that everything that is relevant to this theme should be included into a biography. So what's your opinion on this selective work while composing a biography?
What do you use and what don't you use? You obviously acquire so much more information if you put it all down in the 2,000 pages. Nobody's going to read that, and so you cut it down to 1/10 of that or 1/8 of that or something. And so you're using, pretty highly selective. Because you just have so much information that it could become overpowering, and if you just put everything down, it'd be one of the most boring reads. So you have to arrive at some kind of pattern, some kind of theme after all of the stuff you've read, and thought about, and put in the different files all over this office, different categories. I'll make the same note on an 8 and 11 piece of paper, and then make three copies of that note, and it goes to three different files because they're different pieces of writing in each that I want to come back to later. So you get these patterns, you get these topics, and you start jumbling those, and then you try to arrive at some kind of pattern will emerge.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Sooner. Otherwise, this is, and your pattern may not be right. You can't be sure, but this is the way it looks to you, and look, you've done as much reading about this, as much thinking about it as others, and you may be right, so you go ahead and pursue that kind of line. So that's one of the things that you do. You have to choose the significant fact, incident, detail that will contribute to an understanding of the pattern of the life you're writing about. So that's what I think you're trying to do. Parts, sections of the book, as you know, deal with how to assess letters and journals, and how much are you entitled to invade the privacy of your subject. Very, very dodgy questions, you know, because you want to put down as much as you can, but at the same time, you don't want to cause any hurt to any survivors, for example. There's an incident, for example, in the Fitzgerald case. I got to know Scotty Fitzgerald, who was Scott and Zelda's only child, and we were friends and went out to dinner one time, and I was first getting to know her, and it was in D.C., and we went to a restaurant, and then we went to a bar called Gatsby's after dinner, which seemed appropriate. So I'm doing this Fitzgerald kind of stuff, and I swear, at this bar, this would have been 19... late 70s, 1975, 76, 77, that marijuana smoke was issuing from the vents. You know, the whole place just kind of made you high just to sit there, you know, without smoking anything. Having a drink, though. Scotty liked to drink. So did her father. Anyway, we were sitting there talking, and Scotty told me about the family history of depression and about the suicide of her oldest son. Well, I hadn't known about that. And it's not my blood.
Mm-hmm.
There's enough evidence of depression in the Fitzgerald family, and Sarah family, his eldest Sarah was her name, to make the point without going into that particular piece of information. It's very difficult. Well, what do you do? You don't want to hurt people, you know. At the same time, as long as you made the point, well, this is a family that was troubled. So the idea, that's important to make, because a lot of the biographers have intended to look at Scott as the villain in the relationship with himself, as well as stealing her material or that sort of thing. And I just don't think that's true, and certainly Scotty didn't. You know, it was a complicated relationship, but Fitzgerald was, right now I'm working on this book, doing a, I'm going to be doing a long article or maybe a book on Tenderness of Night, which is Fitzgerald's 1934 novel about a disastrous marriage that, in which the hero was a psychiatrist, psychoanalyst. No, psychiatrist, that's better. Is more or less undone by his very rich, very beautiful wife. And after he's helped her back to health, he deteriorates as she improves. And in the end, he's just exiled off to somewhere in upstate New York, never to be heard from again. So, you know, that was the story of Fitzgerald writing about this battle between the sexes. He saw that in the 1930s as the way his life was going. And he and Zelda were in a struggle for survival. And they were not both going to be able to survive. So he's imagining himself as the victim there. So it did outlive him by some years, but that didn't have a heck of a lot to do with it. That wasn't a consequence of her winning the battle, because she was relatively psychologically impaired from about 1929 on, and she lived another 20 years, but not wonderfully happy ones. So it's, I don't know how I got into this business of the battle between the sexes, except I'm thinking about it all the time now in connection with Tenderness of the Night, which I think is at least as good a book as The Great Gatsby, and ought to be read more of it. Same of the things that, one of the reasons I'm devoting so much time to it. Okay, I don't know if this is anywhere near answer to the question you asked.
Sure. In one of your comments, you mentioned that biographies are somehow in conversation with other biographies, which are written by other biographers. So what's your experience of this kind of conversation? Have you ever had the case when your biography was in some very argumentative dialogue with some other biographies? Or have you observed cases like that? And what do you do out of these cases? Like you mentioned, your work is very selective, and you decide what sections or what fragments about writers' lives to include into biographies and which ones to leave behind. So what's this gap probably between different biographies can inform about biography as a genre, for example?
Yeah, well, that's a complicated question. Well, let me talk about John Cheek. Because my biography, which came out in the 80s, was succeeded 20 years later by Blake Bailey, who's very successful by John Cheek, in which he managed to get access to a number of things I hadn't gotten access to. He got along with the family where I always had. It's the only time I ever had a problem with the family, but children especially, not with Mary Cheever so much. But that, you know, it's difficult to know how seriously to take the rivalry which automatically exists between you and any other biographer who's writing about the same subject. I mean, it's going to be there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So what do you do about it? Well, I've pretty much tried to avoid self-aggrandizement in these matters, and to try to get credit where credit is due. I think Blake Bailey's book is a very good book. I also think mine was a very good book, which not everybody does. Anyway, it's but you know, you're not really bloody conflict with other biographers. You really aren't. I mean, you're both professionals,
mm-hmm.
normal professionals. You're doing your work as best you can, and if you arrive at somewhat different interpretation of the subject, well, of course you will. I mean, there's a famous story about, I think it's from Virginia Woolf talking about being locked up in a room with banker's boxes full of notes, six banker's boxes, and given a year to write a book on the basis of what's missing. And, you know, anybody tackling that subject using the same material will write entirely different biographies. Because every biography, in a sense, contains an autobiography. It's the way you look at the world. It's the way you feel about people, the way you that you can't keep out, right? Nor would you want to, because it's what makes you a human being. And what I think it makes your writing better, too, literary biography is more complicated than other kinds, because you don't have the public record behind you, and then you have lots of writers who take drastic steps to forestall further inquiry after their passing. They assign the job of writing their biographies to their children or their wife or to or they burn papers. Dickens was famous for burning huge piles of his papers, and then others did that too. Roasting marshmallows, open up, they don't want that life to be invaded. John Updike is one among recent writers who felt very strongly about that. He felt that any biographer coming along was likely to find offensive things to say about him. I don't think that's necessarily true. What biographical work has been done on him is to be fair and good. But there has been a tendency, I should admit, going back 20 years or so, when what Joyce Carol Oates called pathography became a kind of genre. That is to say, where your subject is presented in the worst possible light, and every incident or encounter is described in the most unflattering terms. So there are books like that. It tend to be books about celebrities, the Kitty Kelly type book, less about them than about writers. But that has been a tendency. I think it's vanishing. I hope so. And I don't like the idea of savaging your subject. But nor would I be capable of it, I don't think so. Anyway, I would leave it at that.
So to write a biography means to do a lot of self-analysis, self-contemplation, self-introspection, and sometimes it's quite painful to do.
It can be, it's something I don't think any writer, any biographer can avoid. Fitzgerald felt his social inferiority to his people he grew up around in St. Paul. His father had not been a success. His mother was not particularly attractive or social. But he got sent to the best dancing school, the best schools, and that sort of thing. He's always feeling he didn't really quite belong because of the family relationship. I felt a little bit that way growing up in Minneapolis and living in a very nice part of town. My father was a success, but we didn't live at the lake like Minnetonka, where the socially elite tended to live. We didn't travel the same social circles as the president of General Mills in Pillsbury and that sort of thing. I went to the best prep school, reasonably well, but I wasn't really among a kind of social hierarchy. It was up here somewhere. And I felt that. And I knew. So that's a tremendous sense of identification with Fitzgerald. Because I could see it in him where others were not likely to see it. Maybe I'm putting too much of myself into that. I hope not. So that's how these these questions can get complicated. You're in the book.
Right.
Automatic. It's your writing. It's what you're thinking. You got all this material. You're dealing with it. You're not distorting the material in any intentional way. But the pattern you do see, like the pattern of this Fitzgerald's sense of social inferiority, which I think informs all of his work, is there. It's there because I knew it. The people I grew up with would probably think that was ridiculous of me to say these. Because, I was certainly a semi-privileged guy, but there's privilege and privilege.
What biography was the most challenging one?
Oh, okay. What was the most challenging one to write? I suppose because of the legal entanglements and my difficulty with the Cheever family with that. It seemed to be sailing along until very close to publication, at which time the Cheever children decided to throw up legal barriers. Never got to the stage of a lawsuit, although there were certainly letters back and forth from lawyers and that sort of thing. And the book was heavily revised as a consequence, so as not to use just a limited amount of quotation or close paraphrase. I never been through anything like that. We were sitting around, and I'm in New York, and we have this high-priced lawyer who's on the phone to Australia or wherever, and Berlin, where we're talking, and my editor, Bob Loomis, eminent editor at Random House. So we're there, we're sitting around, we're trying to cut every quotation down to 10 words or less. That's not many words. So I go along, I'm trying to compress what's said in this letter of 250 words into one reference of 10 words. It's not easy. So you have to slap yourself on the wrist every time you get to 12 words or something, because this is arbitrary. Random House is being sued at that time for this very same matter in a biography of J.D. Salinger, which was eventually semi-abandoned, and then a book came out that was seriously handicapped by its lack of quotation. So I don't think that was that true of my Cheever book. I'd done a lot of it had to do with, I'd done a great deal of interviewing with people who knew him well, and of course I didn't have to cut down my quotations of that. I have plenty to say about the writing too. It's one of the things that I suppose is semi-unusual. It's not true. Almost all literary biographers I can think of in this country, in the United States, tend to work at institutions of higher learning. That's their bread trip. That's what they do. But they get this bug in their ear, and then they're going to spend 30, next 4 or 5 years working on a particular writer. The tendency is to disparage literary biography because it's written by academics, most of it. Obviously, I no longer teach, although I used to teach a seminar out here where I live once in a while. But I was never an academic writer. I hate academic jargon and that sort of thing. I think having had the early experience as a newspaper writer is tremendously valuable. I'm always writing for the general audience and never for some kind of specialist who wants me to use language in which I convert perfectly good verbs into nouns, or otherwise other way around. I just like, for example, impact is a verb. Okay, I was affected by that. I wasn't impacted by it. I mean, it just doesn't sound right to me. And I know it's a noun, damn it, you know. And so this makes you a little old-fashioned. But it's not like, but I don't think there's any real trace of the academic except the determination to do all the scholarship you can in my work. I hope not. So
you mentioned that you're currently working on Tenderest Light. What's your next biography, or what's your next project?
Well, as I say, I'm working on Tenderest Night. I most recently finished a long 7,000-word piece, which will be the introduction to Volume 4 of the Hemingway Letters, which is coming out next year. Cambridge University Press. Going to be eventually something like 16 volumes of letters, but I got asked to do that. And it's a job of work. I'm not getting a great deal of money for it, but it's compensated, you know, and I'm pleased about that, and I was pleased to be asked to do it, and so, you know, things come along. Mm-hmm. Some of my family thought I might write some kind of autobiographical or memoir type thing. I don't know. I don't think that I'm likely to do that. Actually, quite a bit of my own life got funneled into the Charlie Fenton book and into this, as you mentioned, because of my career path. I had to impossible craft. So there's enough there maybe for children, grandchildren, to find out something about me should they ever be interested in doing so.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think I'd ask one more question about biography as a genre. Have you ever had such an experience when you all of a sudden realize that you're changing your initial vision of the writer you were writing about some years later?
I'm sure I have. Thank you. Facts confound you. Again, as I go back to Virginia Woolf's latest biography of the painter Roger Fry, one of the habitués of Bloomsbury, and she knew quite well. But how can I ignore facts when they keep contradicting my view of things? And there they are, you know. I mean, you can't ignore them, you know, can't get to dismiss them as unimportant. That's another one of the problems of making biography interesting, is that you're telling a story, but you're not telling a story like a novel. Well, you can use certain techniques, but you cannot invent things. You gotta put up a banner that says, "This was not made up. This is what I found out." And it's true as far as anything can be true. It's certainly true to the facts. Okay, facts are not equate to the truth, but with enough of them reasonably interpreted, maybe you can arrive at something like truth. But I don't think you can make things up. And some biographers quite recently have been doing that. But it seems to be a violation of the code. You know, this is not something that we should be asking the public to accept. I think of the biographer of Reagan, Edmund Morgan, I think it is anyway. He's a very accomplished biographer, but he invented this character called Edmund Morgan, who knew Reagan during a period of his life. It's all made up. It was a device in radio biography about somebody who had very little to say. Reagan, as a subject, was almost hopeless, I guess. He just didn't. I was an actor and I became president and did these things, but he was not a good source. So he almost had to make something up to keep it interesting. But that's an extreme case, I think. And speaking of politics, I don't think we'll have any difficulty finding enough of interest to say about the candidates in this particular election. Both seem to be just extremely complicated and difficult people and less than admirable people, especially on one side. But we won't go into that.
What biography code do you follow?
This is not made up. These are the facts that I've seen. So yes, the biographer's code. You begin writing a biography with at least a strong admiration for the work of your subject, and with a complimentary curiosity about what sort of person was able to accomplish such things. You do your dutiful, often exhilarating research, you become a drudge. This is the ideal biography. He has to be a drudge. He has to be a psychologist. He has to be a detective. So you do your dutiful and often exhilarating research, discovering illuminating remarks and unexpected actions along the way. And you read and reread and assemble boxes full of notes. I've got boxes all over this office. Eventually, the notes begin to fall into a pattern. We hope they will. So you shape your book along the lines of that pattern. And you hope to end with understanding. That's all. Invariably, you end with a profound sense of loss when it's time to let Scott or Ernest or E.A. Robinson or Archie MacLeish or John Cheever go back to their rest. And for the rest of us, to return to the what really matters about that, words they let's put down on paper for us to look at. But if that feeling communicates to yourself, we now have a kind of understanding of this person. It may not be totally valid. I hope it isn't totally invalid. But you hope you contributed that to the story. This is not only a story, but it's a story with some kind of point. So if you can go that far, and if the reader feels the same way about it as you do when you're finished, you'll come close to achieving what I otherwise call the impossible craft. You can't get in someone else's head. Freud knew that. You can try, but you're not going to get in there. But you can. You can try, and you can establish the basic themes of a life. We don't present them to the reader, and that's, after all, what readers are after. They want it. They're interested in these people if they're reading the book at all, reading a biography at all, so that they want to arrive at some kind of understanding of a writer that they admire, or you admire, or both of you admire. So that's what I've been doing.
Yeah, that's hard work.
Well, it's hard work, but it's very rewarding.
Yes.
There's never, as I was saying very early on, there's never enough information. But sooner or later, you have to say, this is it. I'm going to put this down and send it off. Okay. Because you can't keep accumulating material, because there's always something new that will come up. And if you keep accumulating all that stuff waiting for something new to come up, it will. If you hold off writing, you'll never get the book written. So you have to get to a stage, say, well, I think I know enough now.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Natalia. Thanks for calling.